in the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who's testified before Congress, has worked in the Reagan administration, the Department of Education, has certainly done investigative work and analysis, is certainly one of the most prolific writers I know, and a great source of information, writes regularly for World Affairs Brief, and we carry a number of his books. But without further ado, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell me, what are we going to cover this afternoon?
Well, we would continue what we started last week, was the power lead in the secret Nazi plan, part three. But as usual, with the beginning of each one of these interviews, I discuss something of contemporary interest, because a lot of my work blends historical information regarding the power elite and their plan over the years and how it's evolved and coming about today. And so there are a lot of things which happen contemporaneous with these events, and so that's what I would begin with today. And it's becoming more and more of a concern that Americans have been dumbed down to the point where we no longer plan and look towards the future and ask appropriate questions of our leaders, our political leaders. We just sort of drift along, and then some crisis comes about or some event, and we as a people say, oh my goodness, look at what happened, and what do we do now? And this is getting actually worse and worse. Now, in the past, I've mentioned the example of Bush, the contrast between Bush and Obama, in the sense of people now in the press, the media, the public, who do not like the Iraq War, say something to the effect of, if we were only back in the year 2000, we really should have asked the candidate Bush running for president that under what circumstances would he take action, perhaps invading Iraq, because his father already had to push them out of Kuwait back in 1991, and they weren't in compliance with UN resolutions and so on. And so we really should have done that back then, and this was a horrible thing, and look at this war we've gotten ourselves into. But at the same time, over the last several years that people have been saying that, Barack Obama was running for the presidency for at least a couple of years, and I don't recall any great public outcry or the press and media saying, okay, we don't want to repeat the mistake of the year 2000, so let's ask this candidate, and all the candidates, but this candidate, Barack Obama, what unilateral action are you prepared to take if, for example, Israel decides in self-defense it has to preemptively strike Iran, because that country is developing a nuclear weapon, and Iran responds by blocking the Strait of Hormuz and doing other nasty things. What are you, President Obama, unilaterally going to do about this? And I say unilaterally because he would probably say, we'll discuss with our allies, but that means either the allies could veto what we want or not, and so what unilaterally would you do? We don't ask that.
No, because often we don't threat of developing a nuclear weapon and using it against Israel. In fact, everything that Mr. Ahmadinejad is doing, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is doing, he keeps talking about how now they have missiles that they can actually fire it and reach Israel, that they, you know, Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth. So Mr. Ahmadinejad is doing everything he can to inflame the situation. Why would any rational leader do that? In other words, why would somebody simply almost be inviting an attack on Iran? Doesn't make a lot of sense, but the question is, what would Barack Obama do if we were faced with Israel attacking Iran and then Iran retaliating by sealing off the Straits of Hormuz and cutting off so much of the oil that is used here and certainly is used in Europe? Pick up the story there, Dr. Cuddy.
Right. And in previous discussions, I've mentioned all sorts of things Iranian agents could do in this country and so forth. The point is, the press and media and the American public, it all really comes back to the American public. I'm not talking specifically about radio listeners, but just the public in general, moans and groans about how we got into the Iraq War, but they don't seem to want to ask the same types of questions of Barack Obama as to what he is about to get us into. And this is not just an isolated incident. For example, recently you had a situation where you had these pirates, and I'll basically call them black teenagers, simply because Barack Obama is black and he keeps talking about empathy. All right, so you had these black pirates, Somali pirates. I think most of them, if not all, were 18, 19, somewhere like that. And they got this crew of American ship, and the captain says, "Take me and leave the crew alone." So they do. And they're out there in the water. And days go by, and the time is passing, and they have demands. I don't know what they asked for ransom. Let's just say it was $1 million, just for the sake of discussion. It's $1 million. And so Barack Obama with the military has this plan, and Barack Obama approves of the plan, whereby...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy is just talking about a sort of a confrontation. Now, what was the specifics of the confrontation that Mr. Obama was going to have to decide on?
Well, a few weeks ago, there was a situation where the captain of an American vessel had been taken captive and held for ransom by these Somali pirates, the black pirates. The reason I mention black only is because President Obama is black, and he keeps talking about we need empathy. Okay, so these Somali pirates take this captain who has given himself to the pirates so that they will not take the crew of his ship. So there they are. And now time has passed, days are passing, there's negotiations. And Barack Obama eventually gives his consent to a plan, a daring rescue, whereby three snipers, American snipers, Navy SEALs, or whatever they were, simultaneously fire their guns and blow the heads off of these three black teenagers. Now, I'm not defending the teenagers. I'm describing the situation. All right? And so they kill them, and the captain is rescued, and everybody says, "Hurrah! Isn't this a wonderful thing?" Okay. And then all Americans in the press go back to eating their pizzas. Now, there's two basic problems with that. The first thing is, President Obama says it's okay to blow the heads off of three black teenagers who have taken a captain hostage. In other words, you kill them to save this one American captain. But the same President Obama says, you cannot waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was responsible for 3,000 American deaths. Now remember, the Somali pirates had not killed any of those crew members. And they hadn't, killed the captain. There's threats all over the place, but they haven't killed. Because as soon as they start killing people, then the game's up. So the Somali pirates, not just these teenagers, but all of them, have a real strong interest in not killing anybody. They threaten, but they understand that if they start killing people, then they're going to get killed. So anyway, we have on the one hand a President Obama who says, yes, blow the heads off of these three black teenagers who have not killed anybody, blow their heads off. But the same President Obama moans and groans. Now, once again, I'm not defending waterboarding. I don't want torture. I don't want waterboarding. It's torture. Waterboarding is torture, and, that's clear. I'm not supporting that. I'm just making a contrast. President Obama says, blow the heads off of three black teens to save this one captain, but you don't. It is horrible. It is totally objectionable to this President Obama to waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is actually responsible for killing 3,000 Americans and has stated repeatedly he wants to kill lots more with more terrorist attacks. Now, where is the discussion amongst the press, the media, and the American public about what seems to be a really bad contradiction? What is the policy? Why is there, where are there really two different President Obamas? Kill three teens who haven't killed anybody, but don't even waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who has killed thousands of Americans and wants to kill a lot more.
Well, don't you think you have to do something to stop the piracy?
Now,
of course, you and I both know that the reason you have piracy there is because the previous administration, the Bush administration, actually helped and financed the Ethiopians who went in there, that put down the Islamists who were controlling the southern part of Somalia, and who'd actually put down the piracy. There was no piracy when the Islamists were in control. We actually financed the people who put down the Islamists, and now you have the pirates, and the pirates are actually having sanctuary in the Ethiopian bases that are financed by the United States. Furthermore, we will not allow the crews or the captains on any of these ships to have weapons to defend themselves. That is totally illogical.
Right.
In fact, nothing going on is really logical other than the fact that, you know, if somebody kidnaps, you know, an American and at gunpoint and they're threatening to kill him, and they certainly could kill him,
right.
I mean, don't you think that they have an obligation to try to rescue the American?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's not what I'm asking. Well, what I'm portraying is there's two different President Obamas. And the question isn't raised beforehand about, you know, what your policy will be, or even after the fact. Now, in America, when people are taken hostage, usually you cooperate with the police, you attempt to rescue, because often when the money is paid, the ransom is paid. They kill the kidnapped victim anyway, so they won't give clues as to their whereabouts and so forth and so on. But I'm just saying, on the one hand, the first President Obama says, kill three people who haven't killed anybody and who really have, they have sort of a track history of, you know, as far as I can tell, none of these pirates has ever taken the money and then killed their victims. So they've got this business going, this game they're playing. It's a bad game. It's an evil game. They're thieves, all that, all those bad things that need to be stopped. And you may want to hit them at their base, you know, at their base where they are in Ethiopia, wherever. But that's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, why does the American public stare what appears to be a contradiction in the face and not ask a question about it?
But, of course, Dennis, the thing is, of course, that we are not asking the right questions.
Right.
Of President Obama has said, you know, terrorism is bad, torture is bad, the things that happened. I mean, we have pictures showing such horrible things at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere in Iraq. We can't even release these, even though, you know, people are demanding that we see these pictures of what our servicemen did. Why isn't he saying, oh, well, you know, we can't show those pictures, you know, they're so horrible. Why isn't he saying, I am the president, we abhor this action, and we are going to take action against the people who carried it out. We're going to take action against the people who authorized the use of torture. We're going to take action against, you know, the people who authorized the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But you see, they focus our attention on all the wrong issues. We spend more time worried about Paris Hilton and Britney Spears than we do about the moral things. President Obama talks about the moral position of our nation, how we're against torture, and yet he refuses to allow the prosecution of the people who carried it out. So basically you have a paradox, and the people really can't imagine what's going on because we see so many contradictory things happening.
Right, and my point is, it's on purpose. There are two different President Obamas for two different audiences. While he says he's against torture and so forth and so on, the same President Obama who says, no, we can't waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is perfectly willing to, as I said, blow the heads off of these three black teens. Because the President Obama who says, I'm against waterboarding, is really a fraud. For example, let's portray an event in the future. The CIA brings to President Obama a captive terrorist. And they say, President Obama, we've got this guy, and this guy knows where, let's make this dramatic. This guy knows where 10 nuclear devices are planted in the U.S. today, and in 24 hours, they're going to go off. And we need to know from you, President Obama, what we can do to this guy in order to extract that information and save millions of lives. Now, that's the type of question one should ask, the press, media, and the public should ask President Obama when he says, I'm against torture. Right, that's the question. All right, so, for example, let's say 24 hours passes, boom, millions of people, New York, San Francisco, Philadelphia, all dead, horrible pain, skin peeling from bodies, all this sort of stuff. What would President Obama say? Well, there may be millions of Americans dead, but at least we didn't waterboard that guy.
But of course, as you well know, the fellow could say anything he wanted
right.
to. And so torture does not work, and the people who are involved in interrogation know it doesn't work. The
right.
only ones who want this are people who are actually sadistic. I want to know why President Obama does demand that those people who've actually been violating the very laws upon which we are, this country is based, and the moral laws of God, why aren't they being held responsible? President Obama is actually protecting these people, saying, oh, we should move forward. That is, of course, the hypocrisy of this whole thing. I think that there is a time for violence. I think that if people have guns and they appointed an American, that he had an obligation to say, go ahead and act. But I think he has an obligation to say, who authorized the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Actually, a lot of these people actually had given up a lot of information. And after they'd given up the information, then they began to torture them. And that is not what's not being brought out. We have sadistic and evil people working at the highest levels of our government, and as a Christian and as an American, I abhor the concept of torture. We should not stoop to this situation. And as far as all this fellow knows where the 10 bombs are, do you think for 1 minute he would tell the American people the truth?
Oh, probably not.
Absolutely not. And so they use this example over and over again to justify torture, and it is simply example of sophistry, where you argue an untenable point to the point where people actually begin to believe it. This is what they did in ancient Greece. This was the technique that Sophocles used, and you know what happened to ancient Greece.
Right. The point is, what Obama is saying, and the reason he isn't prosecuting these people is, it's a sham. It's a fraud.
You're absolutely
he's presenting
right.
that to his audience. But in the end, the real President Obama is the one who did blow the heads off of the three teens to save his life. So what you have is basically another actor in the White House.
Well, everything, of course, is illusion and delusion. Everything is symbolism over substance. It is a play for the emotions of the American people. I mean, who could support torture? I mean, George Bush and Dick Cheney have totally discredited themselves in the minds of most people. And the people, of course, will say, well, my goodness, we have to protect the American people. Don't understand, we're not trying to protect the American people. I mean, we're unilaterally disarming, doing away and destroying our nuclear weapons while the other side's in full production for war. We abandoned our soldiers in the First World War and the Second World War and Korea and Vietnam. And, of course, they're abandoning the American people today. What we need are moral leaders who fear God. And I fear that the people in charge have no fear of God.
Right.
Well, Dennis, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Okay, well, we'll just give one more example of this. And what I'm trying to get is the type of question that should be presented to President Obama by the public and the media so that we actually break down this wall of subterfuge or fraud or whatever that he's perpetrating here and find out in advance, not after the fact, not when some crisis arises, what he is going to do, at least says he's going to do. So, for example, let's say go back to the three teens. Let's say for some reason two of the snipers got their people, but the third one sneezed or something. They missed. He was grazed, and because he thinks he's about to die, he shoots the captain, and he's dead. All right, what would happen? The next day, you'd have the press and media going to the wife of the captain with cameras and microphones in her face and saying, President Obama authorized this, and now your husband is deceased, and do you wish now that they had paid the $1 million ransom? Do you think your husband's life is worth more than $1 million, and so forth? And you know, here we would be in a dramatic melodrama after the fact, when these types of things should really be presented by the press media and the public before the fact, so that we do not have situations in which we are simply reacting. I'm very tired of us, we as a people, reacting instead of asking these questions in advance, so that in advance you know what a President Bush will do regarding torture or Iraq or whatever. In advance, we know what a President Obama would be doing about terrorists kidnapping victims or an Israeli preemptive strike. In advance. That's the point of what I'm trying to make. We need to ask these questions and get answers of our political leaders in advance rather than after the fact. Okay, now back to the article. And what we were talking about last time was part three of the secret, the power elite and the secret Nazi plan as part three. And what we had gotten to was that there was a report, an intelligence report by U.S. military intelligence, and I had mentioned before, it was called the Rittenhouse Report, capital E, capital W, hyphen, capital P as in Peter, little a, 128, and it was written in November 1944 by a French spy who was at this Strasbourg meeting that I mentioned at the Maison Rouge Hotel in Strasbourg, August 10, 1944. And what was happening there was the Nazi officials had ordered this elite group of German industrialists to plan for the Nazis' return to power in a Fourth Reich. So this is, once again, the plan for a loss. Okay, that's where we were last time. Picking up this time, the basis for that plan had been developed years earlier, and that's what I'm trying to get across to the public. This wasn't something that, after the Battle of Bastogne, oh my goodness, it looks like we're going to lose. Let's have a plan for after the war. Let's have some people go underground, so on and so on. No. This is way, way earlier. And I mentioned in the last discussion about Himmler in 1942, talking about we may have to lose militarily, but the Nazi movement itself, National Socialism, must never give up. And that's what he says. That's what we have to start working for now. And this is way early, shortly after America had entered the war and long before it was clear the Nazis would lose militarily. So here you have, in this case, continuing, September 11, 1940, there was a speech by Reich propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels.
And I want you to hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy is talking about this plan, and based upon the article that you can find at News with Views, for the rise of the Fourth Reich. And, of course, there was a plan going back even in the period of 1942 when Himmler was talking about the importance of planning in case the Nazis lost, that they would be able to continue this National Socialist movement, this Nazi movement, as it were. And, of course, there were then, of course, in 1944, some French spy attended a meeting at the Red House. It was a hotel. And basically, there again, they were planning on what was going to be done for the rise of not the Third Reich, but of the Fourth Reich. So you pick the story up, Dennis.
Right. So in September of 40, here you have Reich propaganda minister Goebbels. He's delivering this speech to some Czech, that's Czechoslovakian, intellectual workers and journalists. And his speech is titled The Europe of the Future. And he says, quote, this is Goebbels, in 1940, this is, long before the U.S. even gets into war. He says, quote, I am convinced that in 50 years, okay, that would be around 1990, 50 years, people will no longer think in terms of countries. In those days, people will think in terms of continents. No single European nation can, in the long run, be allowed to stand in the way of the general process of organization, end quote. So, now, I'm trying to get your listeners to sort of stop for a minute and think about this. You have to not only look at the statement, you have to look at the implications of the statement. So in the first place, you have this individual, sounding like he's part of Cecil Rhodes' group here, you know, where they're going to have these continental or, regional organizations, economic unions, and so forth, and then they'll link them up. So on the one hand, you have a 1940 Goebbels basically saying the same sort of thing. They will no longer think in terms of countries, but you'll think in terms of continents like Europe, European Union. But you have to remember something. The way the Nazis were presented to us were, you know, Deutschland über alles, right? So you would think a real strong, determined Nazi would be thinking specifically in terms of countries. So Deutschland, we are superior. The Germans are superior. The rest of you are inferior. You're under our thumb, and that's the way it's going to be. But he's not saying that. He's saying that people will no longer think in terms of countries. That includes Germans. Germans will no longer think in terms of Germany. See, you have to sort of think about these things, not just on the face value, but the implications of what these guys are saying. So now the same thing, same year, 1940s, Goebbels speech, you had another individual. Now this is the Nazi Minister of Economic Affairs. This is a powerful person. Economics runs a lot of the foreign affairs in the world. So here's the Nazi Minister of Economic Affairs from 1937 to 45, to the end of the war. And his name is Walther, W-A-L-T-H-E-R, it's like Walter but with an H. His last name is Funk, F-U-N-K. And in 1940, remember, early on, 40, he writes a 16-page booklet called The Economic Future of Europe. And he calls for a Central European Union and a European Economic Area. Those are these two terms. 2 years later, he co-authors a book called The European Economic Community. That's the EEC, to come. You know, it's not at that time, but that's what they're planning. You know, the Nazis. In which he declares, quote, there must be a readiness to subordinate one's own interests in certain cases to those of the EEC. Now remember, once again, you see, we're looking backwards in terms of, yeah, we got a European Union preceded by a European Economic Community, yeah. But at this time, 1940-42, there is no European Union, there is no European Economic Community. But here these leading Nazis, the Nazi Minister of Economic Affairs, is not only talking in those specific terms of entities which are nowhere near coming about yet, but he, again, this Nazi, this Deutschland über alles, is once again saying you have to have a readiness to subordinate one's own interests. In other words, we have to, as Germans, subordinate our own interests to this larger entity of the European Economic Community. How can a Nazi say something like that? But here they are saying exactly that early on.
Well, don't you think that there has always been, and certainly many people have been manipulated into being going along with this idea of world government? Certainly,
right.
Logic would tell us that, yes, they would be nationalists, but certainly reading the occult literature, they will tell how many people, of course, will adopt their policies and won't even understand why, but they will accept these policies, and certainly this would appear to be what's going on.
Right.
These people are abandoning their nationalist tendencies, embracing the idea of the New World Order, and of course the New World Religion. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Kenny. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dennis, what are your thoughts? Why are the Nazis taking more of an internationalist view than a nationalist view?
Well, because the whole purpose of my writing this series is to say that what has been presented to the public in history books and documentaries about the Nazis is basically false. I mean, I don't want to dismiss it. Hitler was an evil person. They did a lot of evil things. And it's okay, as I've said many times, to look at that as face value. But when things don't seem to make sense, as I've said often in the past, look at it from the perspective of how it meets the power elite's overall objectives. And what I'm contending is that the Nazi movement was simply a subset of this larger movement. And it wasn't something that happened at the end of the war. Oh, my goodness, we're going to lose. What can we do now, you know, for later? This was early on, a plan for a loss early on, because the real purpose of these guys wasn't Deutschland über alles. It wasn't the superiority of the Germans and everybody else as a bunch of, you know, savages out there. They knew all along what the ultimate goal was, because these guys were part of the power elites movement. They were simply a subset doing their thing at this period as part of a big global menace. That's why these guys got funded by American multinational corporations. They were given rise to power, and they were, you know, brought, the downfall was brought about at the appropriate time. They served a useful function. But the leaders knew perfectly well what the ultimate goal was going to be. This, you know, regional, like I said, the Rhodes people, P.E. Corbett wrote, a book in 1942, in which he was saying, you know, they will have these regional entities and they'll link them up. He's basically one of the secret society that Cecil Rhodes had formed, an association of helpers. He was a Canadian. And so here he is in 42. Here's Walter Funk, the Nazi economic affairs minister in 42. All of these guys are like writing off of the same script. And so they're all part of this same overall power elite plan. And so I'm urging the listeners not to just look at what you've read in the history books or seen on documentaries as here's what the Nazis were all about. I'm sure that the lower Nazis, you know, all of the sort of stormtrooper types slugging it out in the trenches and so forth, really believe that stuff. But the leaders at the top were agents of the power elite. And so they really had this planned early on, not as an afterthought, but early on. So getting back to this,
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment here, Dennis. Well, Dr. Stan and Dr. Cuddy was simply raising the question, why would so many of the prominent Nazis early on, even before it was obvious that the Nazis were going to be losing the war, why would they be planning for this world government, this world organization, afterwards moving towards this world society, this world community? And, of course, what we're told is, you know, the Nazis want to rule the world, Hitler wants to rule the world, Deutschland über alles was all part of a scam. We've been convinced of a lot of things that aren't true, because there is always behind the Nazi movement, as behind the movement that was in the West at that time, that this idea to use the Nazi movement to bring about a stepping stone towards the world government. And this is why American corporations were actually building the war materials for Adolf Hitler. Those of you who have read certainly Professor Quigley's book will read about the Cliveden set. This was an English group related to Lord Astor and Nancy Astor, and they were encouraging Adolf Hitler at every turn, doing everything to get, you know, him. Remember, he only came to power in 1933, and by 1938 he was beginning to challenge the leadership of Europe, and of course by 1939 he was in war. 6 years after he comes to power with a totally bankrupt nation, with literally no military, he now has a military that has been built up, you know, that can begin to challenge the whole world. Well, of course, nobody ever mentions it was Ford Motor Company and General Motors Motor Company and International Telephone and Telegraph that was building its dive bombers, the Stuttgart dive bombers, and of course Exxon and major American banks were over there, and IBM was over there helping Adolf Hitler. But we never talk about that, because people might begin to look behind the facade to see the truth. Go right ahead, Dennis.
That's exactly it. You hit the nail on the head, and you might ask yourself, your listeners, is how come I've mentioned this many times before, so I'll just hit it real quickly. How does an H.G. Wells, writing in 1933, The Shape of Things to Come, say there will be a second world war, and it'll be in 1939, and it'll arise over a German-Polish dispute? I mean, how does he know that? Why doesn't he get it wrong by, say, 3 or 4 years? You know, why didn't he say, well, in 1942, maybe there will be? You know, I mean, why would, suppose one of your listeners said, Dr. Stan, he calls in, said, Dr. Stan, got something for you. You say, what? Say, well, in the year 2015, there will be a conflict between country X and Y. Not 2014, not 2019, but in 2015, and lo and behold, 6 years from now, there it is. I would suspect that person might know something. It's not just making a guess at this thing. So when H.G. Wells and these people hit the nail on the head over and over and over again, you might want to start to think that it's all part of a plan. And so that's basically what's going on here. So back to this three-page Rittenhouse report marked secret in 44. Himmler's SS Obergruppenführer's name was Dr. Scheid. He was a lieutenant general. And he began that meeting at the Maison Rouge, that means Red House, Maison, House Red, but the French put the adjectives at the end, Maison Rouge Hotel, and ordered the German industrialists to, quote, make contacts and alliances with foreign firms, but this must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion, end quote. And then he also directs them to exploit the finances of those German firms that had already been used as fronts for economic penetration abroad. And he specifically cited the American partners, Krupp, Zeiss, Leica, and one other one he mentioned was the Hamburg America Line Shipping Company. Now, you got to remember about the Hamburg America Line Shipping Company. That was George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush's Hamburg America Lines, which transported earlier the Nazi, Dr. Ernst Rudin, and other Nazis to that Third International Congress on Eugenics in 1932 in New York, where Rudin was unanimously elected president of the International Federation of Eugenic Societies. So this is one of their firms that they have been cooperating with. And they continue this cooperation during the war through banks and others.
Now, of course, basically the point that Dr. Cuddy is making is that Prescott Bush, which is, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush's father and
right.
George W. Bush's grandfather, had been a senator, but he was intimately involved with the people who were involved with financing Adolf Hitler. In fact,
right.
Their firm was even cited, and you can check this out on the Internet, and was required to pay a large fine for, helping and caring for Nazi funds after America entered the war. But these are the things we never talk about today. I mean, we can't let the American people know there's a little clique that runs the world, and of course the Bush family is part of it. Isn't it strange that we had two Bush presidencies? I mean, how often does that really happen? But go right ahead.
Well, you got to have that alternation of power quickly. You have Bush 1, and then Clinton, and then Bush 2, and then Obama, who's, most of his appointees are former Bush people, and Hillary Clinton's running foreign affairs with Secretary of State. So there's your alternation of power that Quigley said is, that's their plan.
And of course here, Obama is keeping Bush's Secretary of Defense, Robert
sure.
Gates. Nobody ever says, well, I thought we were going to have a shakeup, and we were going to get different people in there. No, they just keep right on going along, and nobody ever challenges what's happening.
That's right, and next time, I'll probably read something from a speech that was delivered a couple of years ago by Dean Koh. His title is a Dean. I think his first name's Harold, and his last name's K-O-H. He was an Assistant Secretary of State the last couple of years of Clinton, and now he's the leading legal advisor for the State Department under Obama. And just a little preview, he's talking about transnational law is the way to go. We've got to have transnational law. And so, once again, deja vu all over again, the same people reappearing. In this case, Yale Law School Dean Koh is Obama's lead person at the State Department talking about transnational law, which, of course, is international law domesticated, applied within the U.S.
What they're saying is we will no longer be a sovereign nation. We'll
right.
simply be another state in this wonderful new world that is coming. And, of course, the people who want this wonderful new world are the ones who put Barack Obama in power. Really nothing has really changed. They have to go through the action every 2 years. We vote for our congressman. Every 4 years we vote for the president. But it really doesn't make any difference. The same people are always in power. It is not simply by coincidence, and anybody wants to check this, we can verify it for you, that every president and or vice president of the United States between 1976 and the year 2008, every president and or vice president just happened to come from the membership roles of David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission. Does anybody think that happened by accident? And what is David Rockefeller's goal? A one world government. Go right ahead.
Right, and so next in this article, I've been quoting a person named Labor in the Daily Mail out of London as I was beginning my News with Views column, so I'm continuing here, and he's writing that, quote, as most of the industrialists left the meeting, that's the Strasbourg meeting, the Nazis, a handful were beckoned into another small gathering presided over by a Dr. Bosse, B-O-S-S-E, of the Armaments Ministry. There were secrets to be shared with the elite of the elite, in other words, a group within a group. Bossett laid out the three-stage strategy for the Fourth Reich. In stage three, German businesses would set up a sleeper network of agents, sound familiar, abroad through front companies, which were to be covers for military research and intelligence until the Nazis returned to power, end quote. So here's where you see it hooking up with that secret Nazi plan that I had mentioned as the main topic of this now three-to-be four-part series next time, where you had this plan early on, way before the Nazis were even going to lose, a plan for a loss, because the real goal was something else other than a military victory. Okay, so continuing this, another person now, a German economist, Ludwig Erhard, had written that their industry, this is the German Nazi industry, could expand after Germany's defeat. Now remember, this is way before they're defeated, but they're planning for this. Germany's defeat through supranationalism, meaning the voluntary surrender of national sovereignty, this is Germans, voluntary surrender of national sovereignty to an international body. They were planning this internationalism, supranationalism. Thus Germany and France were the primary advocates of the European Coal and Steel Community, the ECSC, which created a common market for coal and steel and which would evolve eventually through the EEC, European Economic Community, into what we have today, the European Union. So this author, Labor, in the Daily Mail, wrote that, quote, before the common market could be set up, the Nazi industrialists had to be pardoned and Nazi banker and officials reintegrated. So what happened? This is the fellow I've mentioned before. In 1951, John J. McCloy, there he is again, one of the paralegal agents, the American High Commissioner of Germany, he wasn't there by accident, he issued an amnesty for the industrialists convicted of war crimes. So here it is, John J. McCloy, American paralegal agent in 51, saying, well, you know all those people we convicted, took their money, guess what? Amnesty, they're giving their positions back, their money back, their corporations back, and so on. Because the ultimate goal was a far higher purpose than the piddly little infringement upon these Nazis that occurred immediately after the war ended. Now, 2 years before 1957, the Bilderberg Group held its, there was a particular place here, the Garmisch-Partenkirchen Conference. That was held in 1955. Remember, they were begun in 54. The Bilderbergs, the next year, September 23, 25, and 55, they held this particular conference relevant to, quote, European unity. Now remember, the Bilderbergs was set up by Prince Bernhard, who was an SS officer, Nazi officer, high-level Nazi officer. Prince Bernhard sets up the Bilderbergs, 1954. The next year, European unity is the theme. And if you look at the document which I have from back then, this 1955 conference report, it recorded that, quote, the discussion affirmed complete support for the idea of integration and unification from the representatives of all six nations of the coal and steel community present at the conference. There was some expression by certain European participants of the view that in the economic field, it might be better to proceed through the development of a common market. See, that's what the European Common Market would be named first, before you had the Economic Community and European Union. All right, he goes on here. I mean, the remarks from this report, from the Bilderberg meeting, second year, continues. A European speaker expressed concern about the need to achieve a common currency. Sound familiar? And indicated that in his view, this necessarily implied the creation of a central political authority. So right there, I'm going to stop for a minute. What you have here is economics is used to have a system developed emphasizing continents, if you would, like the Nazis said in their plan, or regional economic entities. And then the ultimate goal of the parallel, the Cecil Rhodes types and so forth, was you would have all of these integrated, and you would say, well, this all, you know, has to be managed. And so the management would be this central political authority, which would be, as I've said often, this world socialist government. All right, continuing now back to the document of the Bilderberg second meeting. A United States participant confirmed that the United States had not weakened in its enthusiastic support for the idea of integration. Integration, all right, at this early stage. Another United States participant urged his European friends to go ahead with the unification of Europe, end quote. So here you have Prince Bernard, SS officer, part of this overall scheme, establishing in 1954 the Bilderberg. The very second year, they're talking about a common market, you have to have a common currency. Once you have a common currency and you link up all of these regional economic entities, there will have to be a creation of a central political authority, which sounds exactly like David Rockefeller's statement from his 2002 memoirs of being part of a secret cabal conspiring against the best interests of the United States in order to form, what does he say, a more integrated global political and economic structure. There's his words again. Political and economic. Here in the Bilderbergs, they say economic and political. Same thing. A common structure. The plan hasn't changed. It's moved forward from the 1955 meeting, the Bilderbergs, to David Rockefeller's 2002 memoirs. They're saying the exact same thing.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think that people have to understand that nothing is as it appears to be unless you understand that the major driving force behind the leaders of both political parties is this one world government. And behind that are powerful spiritual forces which have been directing the affairs of mankind for centuries. This is what it's really all about. But never before in history have we had the opportunity, through the integration of the finances of the whole world, to bring the whole world together, to create a cashless society, and of course to force every nation to go into it, either that or face financial crisis. That's why they created this crisis, and that's why it is going to continue, and we're going to see the collapse of economies, of currencies, the impoverishment of people all throughout the world, long-range planning, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just as an aside here, a couple of examples of what's going on that people don't realize. You have it's like I said about President Obama being a fraud. You know, I hate waterboarding, I hate torture, and, you know, we'll have to end this and do something about it. And then he approves, though, the whacking of the three. And so on. So anyway, what you have is a bunch of actors, politicians who are really actors. And so, in one case, let's talk about the end of the Second World War, you have Richard Nixon, right? The big, big national patriotic type of guy, fighter of communists and so forth and so on. Well, most people don't realize that right at the end of the war, he was a representative in Congress. And on July 9th, I think it was 1946, I'll have to check, Richard Nixon introduces House Concurrent Resolution 68. Now, this is the Richard Nixon who is portrayed as this big nationalist, big patriotic American, right? Resolution 68, he says this is Nixon, that it is the sense of Congress that the President of the United States should immediately take the initiative in calling a general conference of the United Nations pursuant to UN Article 109 for the purpose of making the United Nations capable of enacting, interpreting, and enforcing world law to prevent war.
And isn't that anti-communist Richard Nixon who opened up China, communist
right.
China, to trade with the West? And, of course, we've been doing everything we could to build up communist China ever since then, including shipping our major companies over there like like General Motors and Intel and so many of our major corporations have large bases in communist China, thanks to Richard Nixon, the great anti-communist. If he wasn't an anti-communist, he never could have betrayed America the way he did. Hey, and of course, our guest this evening has been Dr. Dennis Keddie. We carry a number of his books. Go to our website or give us a call of 1-800-544-8927 to get a list of the books Dr. Keddie, we have. Well, Dennis, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay, that the specific day was July 9th, 1947, when a young Representative Richard Nixon, who was supposed to be this big patriotic American, is basically introducing House Concurrent Resolution 68, advocating the UN be a world government. And he's supposed to be a big patriotic nationalist. Well, 20 years or so passes, and once again, you have another young congressman named Representative George H.W. Bush. And this time it's December 2, 1969. Once again, this big patriotic nationalist. And Representative Bush introduces, in 1969 in the House, House Concurrent Resolution 460, which states in part, quote, "Whereas a joining together for such purposes of the democratic nations of the Atlantic Community to create an Atlantic Union within the framework of the United Nations would reduce the cost of the common defense, provide a stable currency, a declaration that the goal of their people is to transform their present alliance into a federal union," end quote. Now, there's several basic elements there. A stable currency by joining Europe and the U.S. into a federal union, not a confederation. But, for example, we know our federal government has sucked more and more and more power to itself at the expense of the state. So if you had a federal union of the U.S. and Europe, we would no longer be a sovereign nation. So here you have this patriotic nationalist, at least he's presented that way, George H.W. Bush, is a young congressman in 69, just like Richard Nixon, basically undercutting American sovereignty. Just like Nixon was in 47, here's Bush in 69 doing the same thing, advocating a federal union between Europe and the U.S., although they're presented to us as really strong, conservative, patriotic Americans.
Nothing as it appears to be, I fear. We're just about out of time here. You have one more thought before I let you go.
Well, I'll end by the way I began. What I was presenting at the first was not an argument for torture, waterboarding, any of this stuff. What I was trying to do is get your listeners to start thinking in advance, not after the fact, and pressing these people who campaigned for 2 years or whatever. What would you do in the case of, let's say, an Israeli attack and the Iranian response? We need to know in advance. What would you do in a situation of, you know, terrorists kidnapping a crew of 15 Americans and so forth? These types of important questions, which have vast and important implications, need to be asked of our leaders in advance. We need to put them on the spot. We need to put the Bushes on the spot in advance, the Obamas on the spot in advance. Not wait until some big crisis arrives and then say, oh me, you know, how will we react?
Well, we're out of time. Our guest has been Dr. Dennis Keddie. Thanks very much for being with us, Dennis. And, of course, this is Dr. Stan. And I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Keddie as much as I did. Anyway, certainly, if you'd like to know more about Dr. Keddie's books, we do carry a pamphlet entitled The Secret Record Conspiracy, Secret Records Reviewed. We have his material on mental health, and certainly we have a number of other books. His book on The Road to Socialism, important books that you should have in your library. And then, of course, we certainly want to talk about the new DVD we're offering. It's called Financial Armageddon, and of course we've been holding it. We gave you the talk some time ago, but we didn't have the PowerPoint presentation with it. Now we have it together. So this will tell you how they created the financial crisis we're in today, where this is going to lead, and of course who it was who put President Obama in the White House. Is there a force behind Obama? Certainly, what is that force? And, of course, how is this going to play out as we move away from being a sovereign nation towards this one world government? Remember, President Obama said, I'm a citizen of the world. Well, I would think he would be the citizen of the United States, and he would emphasize that in preserving our nation. Certainly, if you want to understand what's going on, we've got a great DVD set. It's called The Final Countdown, Part 1, Part 2, each with 5 DVDs in it, by Pastor Billy Crone. We think he does an excellent job. If you'd like to know how the American corporations financed Adolf Hitler, we carry the book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. That's Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler by Professor Sutton. And, of course, if you haven't seen my DVD, The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, an interview I did with Professor Sutton before he expired, we do have that available. We carried the book, long suppressed book, but so important, by Bill Clinton's mentor. The book is called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which tells you how the people in England, specifically the Cliveden set, and those associated with Cecil Rhodes' secret society, were actually encouraging Adolf Hitler and building up Adolf Hitler in preparation for the coming war with Adolf Hitler. But, of course, you couldn't let the American or the English people know that it was all a scam, that we were actually providing weapons for Adolf Hitler. General Motors and Ford Motor Company and AT&T and DuPont were over there. Of course, IBM was there as well. And they were actually providing the weapons for Adolf Hitler, building the weapons there in Germany. There's another book we don't carry. It's called Trading with the Enemy by Charles Hingham. You can get it up on the Internet. Going into how actually the Exxon tankers, Standard Oil tankers, were providing the diesel fuel for the German submarines that were sinking American ships during the war, after America had ended the war. But you can't let the American people know that any more than you can get them to realize that during the Vietnam War, the United States was funding Russia, that was funding the North Vietnamese, that was funding the Viet Cong, were killing our boys. We've got a great talk called Iraq, The Untold Story. Comes with an excellent syllabus. These are the things you need to get. You need, of course, to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, which will give you the overview of what's going on and who it is who is really energizing what's going on. I mean, why did they take God and prayer out of the schools in the United States in 1962? Who was responsible for that? Who controlled the Supreme Court at that time? And you're never going to hear this through regular channels. That's why the book Brotherhood of Darkness is, I think it's had about 8 printings. It's been taken on by a major printer and their publisher, and they're going to be re-releasing that within the next few weeks. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. We recommend the book to you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I want to tell you, I think something big is going to happen in the next few weeks. Gold was up $25 today. Silver was up 57 cents. It's like the canary in the mine shaft. It foretells something serious going to happen. And, Chris, please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection until Monday. May the Lord be with you. Yes, Dan, here. Look, did we hook up with you initially?
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.